This is To Catch a Con Man, Season 2, in the Victim's Voices. I will take you on another fascinating journey, but this time you will hear from other men and women that, like me, have fallen prey to the various cons, scams, and deceits by one of the most prolific and successful con artists to live and operate in the Midwest. You know him as Ricky Dugo.
Could $100,000 sustain my life? It couldn't even come close. So listen to me. If I was going to be in some sort of con, scam, conniving thing, it'd be for millions. It wouldn't be for $100,000.
To Catch a Con Man is brought to you by Studio 847 in Long Grove, Illinois. Listener discretion is advised, as some of this programming contains language and content that might be offensive to some listeners.
Join me on this adventure to catch a con man. This is Adam Albin. It's been some time since the last episodes were published, and I wanted to go back into my recording archives and publish this next set of interviews. These next few episodes will be of a slightly different nature. We will talk to one of his earliest girlfriends, a woman who we will call R.E.M., who dated Ricky Dugo in 1984. While not a financial crime victim, she provides the earliest memories of the fraudster that we have shared on this podcast. Coming up next, part one of her two-part story.
High school, they would have a, at a bar in the area, they would have like a juice bar, and they would, I think it was Thursdays or Sundays, one of the nights, but they would have one night that they would kind of hone for the teenage group, and it would be a dance club, back with Madonna, back with, you know, Billy Ocean, like that kind of a music, and there's still some break dancing stuff like happening around then. My sister and another friend of mine had gone, and this is probably a consecutive, maybe two or three, four times that I've been there. And we're just kind of, you know, hanging out, and happened to see this guy with two other guys. And he had come walking up, and again, 17, maybe just turned 17. So, I mean, like, I had just got my driver's license. So we're at the bar, or the juice bar, and he comes up and starts talking to us and asks me to dance. Nobody else, just me, you know, not anybody else. He wasn't interested in anybody else in the group. Asked me to dance, and I did. And, you know, back in the day, it was like, what was that movie? Valley Girl with Nicolas Cage. And I remember thinking, you know, this guy kind of reminds me of, like, you know, kind of like that look. Like, he just had something. I'm like, all right, I'll dance with you. And believe me, I haven't dated much before this point, but I went and danced with them. You know, I'm just got my license. I'm feeling pretty good about, you know, maybe venturing out and being, you know. So dance with them, and turns out, you know, it's this guy, Rick Schulte. And he proceeds to tell me that he was a model, that he was from the North Side. He drove a Mustang, that he, let's see, that he played football for Loyola. And, you know, as a 17-year-old, not knowing too much about that, later found out that Loyola doesn't even have a football team. But I bragged to all my friends after we started kind of dating that my boyfriend played for Loyola. So needless to say, you know, he's from the North Side, I'm from the South Side. I'm in school. Again, at this point, I'm thinking, you know, whatever. He told me, this is kind of funny too, because the stories that I heard with you, and I get it because he's older now, he wants to be younger. He told me he was older. So all this time I thought he was over 21. And I did think, I'm like, what is he doing at a juice bar if he's 21? And also questioning, like, he's much older than me. But anyway, went along with it. So that was the start of how I knew him. I exchanged numbers, kind of got in contact, got in contact. He'd come over by me. I'd go out by him. Maybe about 3 months into it, I happened to come across, like, he was sitting on my mom's stairs at my house in Evergreen Park. And I think his license came out or something that had identification. And I saw that he was my age. And I questioned, I'm like, well, why would you say you're 21? And of course, I think, as you know, how smooth he is, he was just as smooth back then. And I probably never even questioned it again. I met his mom and his sister, and that was a very interesting, they were definitely very different.
Yeah, talk about that. I mean, what made them different?
Well, so the mom didn't like me. You can just tell she didn't like me, but she had a very, kind of like a very standoffish kind of, I don't know, vibe. And maybe she was like that with everybody. I think she might have worked at AT&T, like out on the field or something. She was a, kind of like a harder woman, kind of. And the sister definitely was, I almost feel like she was totally enamored with her brother. I just got this weird thing that no matter what, it was like that was her little brother. And just no matter what he did was okay in her book. One of the kind of the weird things is that, so Rick's mom had been married to a guy that they called Izzy. I don't know if that's ever come up in the past.
Mm-mm.
But the guy, every time I had gone over there, was always in the basement. Always. I guess they had, I remember going in the basement and meeting him, and it was just very, very strange. And I thought, this is weird. But then I find out that Izzy did not like Rick, and he had told Char, I think her name was Char, Rick's mom.
I believe it was. Yeah. Charlene?
That he didn't want him in the house. I mean, and again, at 17 years old, he was like not to live in the house. So at 17 years old, he would come in the house. He would be there in the day, but later on, he had to leave. And at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, there was a certain time that Izzy would go to bed, that Renee would come down the stairs and unlock the door, and Rick would go up and sleep in the house. Now, the back bedroom was disarray. I can't imagine that he slept there. I can only imagine that he slept in Renee's room.
Hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard that story before.
No, I haven't.
Yeah. So, I kind of question what kind of relationship Rick had with his own sister. But, again, I don't want to speculate.
No, go ahead and speculate. It's all good. I mean, you know.
I can't imagine that Rick, I mean, the type of person that he is, would sleep in a room that was just filled with a bunch of crap and, like, mattresses that were just, you know, strewn all over, dirty. They had, you know, with dog poop and stuff all over. So I can only imagine that he probably slept in his sister's bed. I mean, there's only one bed in the sister's room.
So
there was just like a weird, a weird vibe that I felt. And again, I'm 17 and I'm fresh on the scene. So again, a lot of this stuff is just, this is kind of normal, I guess. So, back then he had a GPZ 1100.
Yeah, motorcycle.
Very fast bike. That, of course, my mom said, don't you ever go on. And I did, you know, I'd get on the back of the bike around the block, and I'd get on the bike and go. He had a lot of friends that would ride bikes with him. I remember a guy named John who lived somewhere like on Sunnyside or something. He was one of the guys that was with him the night that I met him at Pine and Tender, which was the bar that was the juice bar on like 79th and Harlem. And there was a point where, I mean, they would just ride very erratically fast, drive in between cars. And at one point, two of his friends, I guess they were riding on the same bike, got into an accident and got killed. And I had gone, my sister and I hopped in the car and went to the hospital to where, like, this, where they were taken and stuff like that. I don't know if this holds any bit of credentials or anything, but this is just some backstory. But he did have a GPZ 1100. He also had a I think it's an AMC Javelin car.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like beautiful blue, an old car. Again, I don't know how he had the money. I didn't even ask. It was cool that he had a car. A couple of times I drove it back home to the south side, which was probably about 45-minute drive. It probably was stolen. Who knows? But he let me drive it home. So that was something that was in there. And I think that was maybe for about a month or two. And then he said he was getting the motor redone or something like that. And I think after that, the car was no longer, like, I never heard of it again. So whether he's up to maybe his con ways then were questionable. But probably one of the earlier times, now that I'm, you know, kind of coming back, I wrote a lot of things down and just like kind of jotted it down. But so he had, his grandfather was still alive, and the grandfather lived in the house. And he told me that his grandfather gave him money to buy a Corvette. And he drove the Corvette a couple of times. I mean, he barely had the Corvette for probably maybe a month. And when he left my house one of the nights, almost getting onto the highway, which was probably like 87th and the Dan Ryan, like maybe about a block before, he crashes it with another guy friend that was in the car with him and completely totaled the car. So from my understanding, when the insurance came back, he got like $10,000 for the cost of for the insurance part of the accident. I don't know how, this is what he told me, but he had a lot of money to go out and spend going shopping. And I'm like, it didn't seem right, but he went out, bought clothes, bought boots, bought shoes, bought a ton of things, bought me stuff. And I mean, I kind of felt like that was not right, but again, at my age, and him telling me that his grandfather said it was fine for him to have. His grandfather was older, so I guess I just never even questioned it.
What color was the Corvette?
I can't 100% remember. Okay. Maybe white?
Yeah, okay. And then you mentioned that he was riding motorcycles with a guy named John. Mm-hmm. There was a guy he used to hang out with named John St. Pierre.
Okay.
Is that, could that be him?
Was he blonde?
He probably was. The pictures that I've seen. So he was well known as like a professional motorcycle rider later, like in his like early 20s. So probably right after you met this guy, he was like on the professional motorcycle scene. And then eventually he was killed in the mid 2000s or early, maybe like 2010. Somebody had just sent me something about the guy that came up in the David Andrew interview, which was just released last week. It was a guy named John St. Pierre. So I'm thinking if you mentioned a guy named John and it was on a motorcycle, you know, I'm just trying to put two and two together. Most likely it was John St. Pierre. After this call, I can send you a picture that was sent to me of him. And maybe you could recognize his face. Just okay.
Doesn't sound familiar.
Okay.
So, I mean, like, it seemed like out of, you know, after seeing him more of a few times, it kind of seemed like he probably had more of his stuff together than Rick did. Like, it seemed like, I don't know if they were, you know, buddies from the younger days, maybe school days when he did go to school or whatever, but I had heard, and again, I don't know where I got the information that he was dyslexic. Rick, I don't know if he's, I mean, like, was he able ever to read anything? I know I had heard about his dad. He had never, but one time, he talked about his dad very little. When he did talk about his dad, he did mention something about Mop, and that was going back then. There was one time that he said his dad, and his, I guess his dad, I think it was his boat, was in Montrose Harbor, and we went there once. I don't remember the guy being threatening. I didn't feel like he was like a mob guy, and he was never, ever around other than that one time that, you know, like maybe in a year and a half. So I don't know if his mom and dad got divorced when he was really young, and he, it was his Walter Mitty life that he thought his dad was this grandiose mob guy, or, you know, if he just, I don't know.
So I didn't actually know that his parents were divorced. I've only heard little bits and pieces about the father. I believe his father's name was Ulrich.
And that's what I remember him saying too.
And so Rick made him out to be a mobster or in the mafia.
Yeah. I don't know if that, again, if that was his made up thing to make people a little bit more afraid of him. I do think, I mean, when I met Rick, he was tall and thin. And I see, you know, I was at a Hawks game probably about not even 10 years ago. And I saw him there, a couple other guys. And he was big and bloated and like brown. And I started shaking. I'm like, I don't want, and he was looking over by me. And I'm like, I hope he does not know who I am. Because it just made me shake. It made me feel very uncomfortable. Just because I just knew, I didn't know. So I want to go back as to how I kind of found you.
Sure, go ahead.
This was going back 84, 85. But maybe about, after dating him about a year and a half, I finally broke it off with him. Because there was just a lot of things. There was incidences, situations that just wasn't right. I mean, thankfully there was a lot of distance between us where we lived that might have made it a little bit better, but it was still very difficult. He was very controlling, very insecure, very jealous. So I worked at Hair Performers. And when I broke up with him, like he came to Hair Performers and he was like, he was ready to kill himself. He was like, I'm going to kill myself. And I was like, no, oh my God. Like, you know, we can talk this out. I mean, like that's the extent that he went to just for manipulation. Well, he had, you know, he was definitely, had other girls in his life. Cause there, I remember a couple of times, you know, the phone would ring in the garage or something. He'd pick it up and I'd hear girls kind of screaming on the other end. I'm like, well, what's that? Oh, you know, he made up a story about it and, you know, me being naive, whatever. So anyway, but after that was all said and done, somehow I was able to escape. He probably had 15 other fires going on at the same time, which, you know, me kind of being separated, that was fine. So I didn't hear from him for a long time. So fast forward to 2020. And I was about to move into a smaller place, and I had tons, I mean, I'm talking tons of pictures and stuff from our relationship. I mean, Great America pictures, you know, where they do those caricature pictures. He went to my high school graduation. I mean, tons of pictures that I said, what the hell do I even have these for? So I threw them out.
No, no.
I know. I'm sick to my stomach that I thought I saved one picture. And I, before you, when we were setting all this up, I looked high and low and I cannot find it. So anyway, so after, you know, I had thrown it out and, you know, I was ready to kind of move. I'm like, you know, I wonder what happened. I guarantee you he is dead. I mean, like he lived a very reckless life. Guaranteed he's dead. So I Googled him. I actually Googled Rick Schulte obituary Chicago because I thought maybe that would pop up. And what popped up was the don't be scammed by Ricky Dugo. And I'm like, what? What? And it was connected to the Schulte name. So I clicked on it and there's his big old brown face in a picture with a shorter girl with dark hair saying, you know, and I read the thing saying that he scammed her with tattoos and this and that. Well, I didn't realize the extent of the scamming he did until I started reading more of the comments that came in on that page. And I think I might have seen yours or maybe somebody else's thing saying, if you know anybody or if you've been scammed by him. And I'm like, I'm not getting involved. Like, no way. Like, I don't want...
Yes.
I don't want to be a part of any of that.
So you
and
found...
I've been watching it all along, and I felt like I had a little bit of a story to at least kind of... to present.
So, and you found the dirty. You are one of the few that found the dirty. Good for you. The dirty was after the Facebook spoof page disappears, the dirty was up for about a year and a half. And it was a very risque kind of page. It was in a public shaming, you know, anybody could post anything. The interesting thing, and I have not even delved into, so the dirty's not around anymore. The dirty was decommissioned. It was, the entire dirty site is gone. Like, if you go to www.thedirty.com, it does not exist, okay? But...
Does that post still, is it still there or no?
So I haven't been able to find the post. However, I still have the post. My buddy Faraz... who is an amazing note taker and loved to pull stuff off the internet about Dugo, created a PDF document. So I still have access to all of those comments on the dirty. So this is great because I've always wondered who was watching those pages, who was reading those comments, you know, like, because there was, go ahead.
I guarantee. There's a lot because, I mean, I come from basically under like a wood pile because it's been so long that if I saw it, then I guarantee you there's other people since that have been screwed over that has seen it. And it's just a matter of time before they come out.
So when you're reading all of these things on the dirty, what are you thinking?
Well, one, I wasn't surprised, but I was taken back at how... well and polished he was able to get away with what he did. I mean, like, I don't know how anybody can possibly manipulate that well. I don't know how he's kept everything in line and how so many people with the same story that, you know, I mean, like, you know, the one girl from Vegas, when she mentioned on your podcast, you know, it's like, you know, I was kind of embarrassed, like almost like she was saying she was embarrassed to even admit. But then when she saw other people and people that are smart getting connived by somebody that is so manipulative, you know what, when he will manipulate or he manipulated people, and believe me, it was groomed. Knowing that he can get away with it, because I guarantee you, I can already tell you're a very empathetic person. You're a very trusting person. You're not a manipulator. You're not somebody that even understands how manipulation works. And guess what? The same with me. And probably with most of the people that he did that with, because there's no way that he would be able to get away with that with somebody that doesn't have that empathetic soul, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. And I agree with you. You know, it goes back to people think that he wasn't all that intelligent. I mean, honestly, like, it comes up all the time. Like, oh, I would talk to him. He seemed like he was dumber than a box of rocks. I mean, literally, it comes up almost every conversation. I say this to them. I say, listen, I'm a successful guy. I do very well for myself. You know, mm-hmm. College graduate, pretty smart. So smart, in fact, that as a normal dude with a career, you know, I was able to accomplish something with a lot of help that a lot of people in law enforcement just couldn't. So, uh-huh. So I'm not saying I have an IQ of 150 plus, but I'm not, I know who I am. And if I got taken by this guy, I mean, that's the first thing out of my mouth. If this can happen to me, this can happen to you, you know, because that's how polished he was. That's how intelligent he was. He obviously had some sort of pattern from a young age where you say he's groomed. All of those things make complete sense, because by the time he gets to me and everybody else over the last 20 years, I mean, mm-hmm. we don't see any of it coming, you know?
No.
So keep on going. Yeah, this is good. So,
I have to say, it's easy for somebody after the fact to say, yeah, he was like a box of rocks. I mean, the guy was a big like doofus looking guy with a tan, you know, with the muscles, this and that, portraying like this, you know, like you guys said, meathead. And it's easy to judge it after the fact, but you know what, the guy, he had something about him that was somewhat believable, because he was very jovial, very, you know what I mean, and very, what's the word? I can't think of the words right now, but
he had a swagger to him. He had this, people were enamored. I mean, I'm telling you, people were enamored by the dude. I saw it at the gym. I mean, and I wasn't like best buddies with him, but I would go to the gym and like people would like want to be like the guys hanging out with him. They wanted to be in the Dugo crew. They wanted to be those Dugo wannabes. I never really understood it, you know, but there are so many. Go ahead.
Definitely money plays a big part. I mean, if he shows up, a big guy, and I do have a theory about his, of course, steroids. He was doing, that's how I knew about Diana Ball, I think. I think he was shooting Diana Ball steroids back when I knew him. But the thing is, he was so skinny when I met him. I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I almost think at one time somebody kind of offered to fight and he backed down. I really think that the size that he ended up being was intimidating enough for him not to have to fight. Because have you ever seen him in a fight? I think every bit of what I heard of your stories is that everybody was so kind of scared that he would wrath on somebody. I guarantee you he's never been in one fight.
So all of what he portrays today, or what he was portraying, he used size and intimidation as part of the psychological con. That's why so many guys and girls never went after him. Because you have a guy that, you know, David Andrews says it best, you know, or actually the Ron says it best, you know, these guys were like, you know, they could have been 6'3 and 165 pounds, but there's Dugo at 6'2 and 250. You got, like, in their heads, they think they have no chance. There's a certain point in time, though, where you take size out of it. And if you get so mad and you totally get out of your mind, size doesn't matter. When you want justice and you want your revenge. And so I think Rick was always fearful of that. And you're right. He always backed down to a fight. But what he would do is he would kick and scream and turn every shade of red. And you would literally think that you were about to get your ass kicked. I mean, it was – I stood toe-to-toe with him. I can tell you I saw it in his eyes. It was like it was either he was going to punch me or he was going to back down. There was no in-between, you know. So but you're right. I mean, that's all part of the con.
He had every bit of the manipulation down to a complete science he made sure that he looked intimidating. Without a doubt, if you were to ask anybody, nobody's probably ever seen him fight. I think that if anybody were to stand square to square with him, you know, somebody that's comparable, you know, I mean, he used his size for sure. And, you know, most people would be like, oh, I'm not getting involved with that. But if somebody equal to his size, but you know what? Nobody probably that he dealt with was his size. He was not going to go head to head with somebody that was going to be comparable to his.
Yeah. But I mean, that's
everybody was very intimidated.
But that's, you know, and that's why by the end of it, and, you know, I'm going to just say it straight up, we all call him a pussy. Because,
yeah. Oh, for sure.
You know, like at the end of the day, what I know now, again, when you push somebody, you start messing with their finances, you start messing with their emotions, and you know, you just get into a place that it's so dark and evil. You know, I have no guilt in wanting him dead. I mean, like, and that's a crazy thing to say, but that's that he and I'm not the only guy or girl. So,
he's still alive. That's why, hearing your stories, I can't believe he's still alive. I really can't. Before I even heard your stories, I couldn't even believe he was still alive.
Right.
Just because of the way he lived his life at 17.
were the things that you saw that were like red flags? Like what?
Well, first of all, I was 17, so of course I didn't have much to compare to other than the fact that very controlling. I mean, to the point where it's like if we would be riding in a car and I would just happen to look out the window, we're at a stoplight, look out the window, and there was maybe a guy, a younger guy, anybody in a car next to me, what are you looking at? You know, like one of those. So, I mean, like it became to where I became very subservient in a relationship. I had nothing else to compare it to. I was very young. So I became very subservient. I became like what he, like a little sword. I was in high school my senior year. At lunchtime, he would want me to call him on my lunch break. The whole lunch break, I was on the phone with him. If one of my guy friends that I knew from grade school walked by, hey, Beck, who's that? I'm going to kick his ass. You know, I mean, like one of those. So, I mean, it was very, very, I mean, like red flags times a million. Red flags that he lied about every bit of who he was when I first met him. I was a perfect supply for a narcissist that I lived so far away that he can keep me on the game but still play his game in the north suburbs. But the thing is, he never once, probably because he knew I didn't have anything, my family didn't have anything, never once was I ever approached with any bit of a con at all. There was a different, weird, sensitive side to him that he was also very protective. And I don't know if I felt that was a, maybe that was his lure of kind of keeping the manipulation kind of going as well.
So you guys were never pitched for a car or $500 or?
Never.
Okay.
Never, but I did. I mean, he had the GPZ 1100. He had the Javelin car. He had that Corvette. All in that time when literally there were times that I'd go over to his house and he would be scraping change from where we can find it to get a burger at Burger King. So I don't know where he got the money. If it's true, again, when I said it could all be smoke and mirrors, everything that I knew about him could be completely not what I thought. But his grandfather, when he was older, that lived in the house, from what it sounded like, his grandfather gave him the money for the Corvette. If that's the truth, he definitely had no problem scamming his family. And then on the return, after the car was considered totaled after the accident, that he got a check for the amount of the car, like, I think it was like $10,000, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was like, let's go shopping. And I was thinking, I just don't think that that's right. And it's like, my grandfather, he just pretty much, like, he said that it's mine. Oh, okay. So, I mean, like, those are things, and these are, like, I'm sure he, at that time, he was perfecting his craft. It wasn't a complete science at that point.
Coming up next time, REM explains why nearly 40 years later, she felt the need to tell me her story.